Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive, just what it says out here. And Don Mohler and I get together, and we have not had an ice cream social really here this summer, but we do. Maybe a little wake and bake, maybe a little honey graham, maybe a little key lime pie. Don, what is your favorite? Have you? I've not asked you that question yet this summer, and I know you've sampled many of the flavors.
I have sampled many of the flavors. You know, I go back and forth, Nestor, but I have to tell you, I have a hankering for the pistachio. I thought it was fantastic.
I made the mistake of going into the freezer 3 weeks ago out there, and I came home. My wife was going through all of them, and she's like, there's no pistachio. So I have, you know, you got me hankering now. I haven't had the pistachio in like 4 weeks. It's before 4th of July, so we'll get that done. State Fair, my wife and I went out the other night. We had the lamb chops, which were unbelievable. They were like chicken-fried lamb chops, incredible. We also went with the gyoza and the pan-fried pot stickers. And, Don, I put the pictures up and everything, but I did not put the chicken and waffles up until the morning. I didn't want anybody thinking I really ate that at 8 o'clock at night, but I did.
Well, you can't go to State Fair without getting the chicken and waffles and the extra raspberry syrup, right? That's the key.
Well, this one came with that because they must have known it was me. Fadley's will also ship you crab cakes. We miss being over the Lexington Market. We have so many pieces up in the Baltimore Positive repository. You can go back and check all the stuff, all the people. Brandon Scott, our chat with him in front of the crab cakes. We missed Amy down there. We're going to get her and grab her next week as well. Moving to Catonsville, Fadley's, all of our great sponsors, and Mohler and Gary Realty. Let's not forget about them. Jeff Mohler's up in the buyatoyota.com audio vault. We talked about this incredible housing market and low interest rates and how houses are moving. Find them at Mohler and Gary Realty. Don Mohler, I'm going to give you the floor right now because we've been tracking down lots and lots of people that were literally on the first get list back in January, a year and a half ago, before all the mess of folks we wanted to have on, and this episode is specifically one of those.
Well, certainly timely, Nestor, when we get a chance to chat with former Baltimore City Police Commissioner Kevin Davis, public safety, crime in our big cities, always in the news, and Kevin out now working as the director of consulting for Garda World in the United States. So we're going to have him catch us up on that. But Kevin, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Hi, John. Thank you and Nestor for having me. And I just can't get my mind off of Fadley's crab cakes right now.
Well, that, you know,
I have an appetite.
That's the cost. People say, what's the cost of COVID? The cost to you right here, right now, is we're not sitting eating crab cakes because that's the way we generally do this, you know. So it is this, and it's starting to stack up, you know, these months. I mean, first off, bring us up to speed on you and what you're up to. I mean, I don't know you, but I know we've crossed paths at Ravens and Orioles and here and there and television, and I know you from the TV, but where you been lately?
Well, sure, Nestor and Don, and congratulations on the podcast. That's great, and I'm honored you guys had me on. So after nearly three decades in policing Prince George's County, Anne Arundel, and my last 3 years in Baltimore as a police commissioner, I was back and forth for a couple years to a Boston startup company as their chief security officer, and for the last several months, I started as the director of consulting for Garda World, and Garda World's actually the world's largest privately owned security and cash services business. So it's a big corporation, and I'm just glad to be on their team.
Well, Kevin, I noticed, I looked at their website, 102,000 employees in 45 countries. Give us a sense of what they do, because I think people hear that and they say, well, what does a security company do? Why do I hire them?
Yeah, well, it's huge, Don. And, you know, Garda World, and people have probably seen the Garda, G-A-R-D-A, armored trucks. And, you know, it's just like the other armored trucks you'll see that transport cash. But there's a huge physical security guarding component with security officers. There's cash services and executive protection. Financial, cyber, internal investigations for big corporations. And then in some countries, Don, they do extortion and kidnapping mitigation for folks. So it's a big, big company, and I'm only one of 102,000, but I'm honored to lead the consulting piece of it in America, and we're doing a lot with COVID and reoccupancy and reentry now. So it's tough, but it's like building an airplane in midair.
Yeah, I would think that, like for everybody else, the pandemic's greatly affected what you've done the last 6 months. Where you were and where you are, we're all a lot different than we were 6 months ago, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm old school, and I still come to work basically every day because I just don't have the self-discipline to work from home effectively. So I got to get up and get dressed, and I need a routine. But certainly the world has changed, fellas. There's no doubt about it.
Well, Kevin, before we get into your recent op-ed where you talk about the need for a federal cabinet-level position for the police, when you mentioned your background, it raises a question for me, and I have to tell a little bit of a story. And Nestor, I don't know that I've even told you this, but, Kevin, you come from Prince George's County, Anne Arundel County, and then to Baltimore City. And I will tell you that during my years in the county, when we had former city folks come from the mayor's office to work for us, they would occasionally say to me, I know that you all think that crime is an issue in the county and you're always on top of crime and you're worried about it. Don, and they would say it respectfully, you don't have a clue. You don't have a clue. I hear you giggling. Give us a sense of the change when you came to Baltimore City from two suburban districts. And are my staff members right when they say to me, Don, you don't have a clue?
Well, Don, I think they meant that with all due respect. But with all due respect, they were right. Now, I hail from Prince George's County. And, Don, you know, Prince George's County, we've had our fair share of violent crime issues, scandal and corruption over the years. And Prince George's is now a comeback story, kind of like Washington, D.C. is, where we've cut our murders in half and the political corruption days are in our rearview mirror finally. But when I got to Baltimore, particularly hailing from Prince George's County, and I was a narcotic guy, I was a SWAT guy, you know, I did all that stuff. When I got to Baltimore, I'm like, this will obviously be very familiar to me because I've already policed in a tough jurisdiction. But there is no comparison, Don. The volume of violence and trauma and actually, you know, political meddling is on steroids in a place like Baltimore. And, you know, if I could wave a magic wand over Baltimore to reduce violent crime, it would be the drug addiction epidemic. That's been going on for far too many years. You know, Baltimore's population is estimated just under 600,000 now. And I remember Dr. Lena Wynn, the former health commissioner who served with me when I was police commissioner, she would tell me routinely that there are conservatively, out of about 600,000 residents in the city, 35,000 addicts who were addicted to heroin and oxycodone and opioids. So drug addiction really drives the drug distribution market and drives the violence, and the retaliatory violence down in Baltimore is so real you can cut it with a knife. It's something else.
Kevin, I want you to pick up on that point because I've had a former police chief one day, and I won't get the numbers correct, but you'll get the gist of what I'm about to say. A former police chief walked me through one day the numbers that Dr. Wynn shared with you and began to put a dollar amount on the amount of goods that had to be stolen in a normal day by someone addicted to drugs who then had to turn it around and sell it for street value. And the amount of goods that had to be stolen was in the millions of dollars regularly just to support a drug habit.
Right. Well, Don, I always tell people, whether it's in Prince George's or Anne Arundel or Baltimore City, that people think about where they live and they consider putting a for sale sign in their front yard when their house is broken into, when their car is broken into, or when there's blight and graffiti in their neighborhood. So the 6 o'clock news stuff, which is important, the murders, the non-fatal shootings, and those types of things, that's not what people consider when they decide where they want to live. And for profound drug addicts to support their drug habit, what are they doing every day, Don? I mean, you know the answer to this. They're breaking into cars.
Yep.
They're breaking into commercial construction sites and stealing copper. They're breaking into houses and going to pawn shops and scrap metal facilities. They're doing all they can to support that terrible, terrible drug addiction that has a grip on so many people in a city like Baltimore. And, you know, there's so much to it. It's so complicated, and it's a tough city to police.
Kevin Davis is our guest. He's now the Director of Consulting Services at Garda World, but, of course, the one-time Baltimore Police Department Commissioner in 15, 16, 17, 18 period of time, but a long, long time in the D.C. suburbs. You know, we talk about this. For me, I live at the harbor, right? I've lived down here almost two decades since 2003. And the reason this thing got birthed out of me doing sports for so long was just seeing the changes in the city with business, friends of mine losing business. But more than that, the perception and the perception brought on by lots of things that probably began with The Wire, right? And, you know, and that was during your time when you were in PG County, that sort of, I guess, narrative was being painted about Baltimore in some sort of semi-fictional way. And then what it means to a guy like me who's invested my whole life in Baltimore and tried to sell my condo 2 years ago and literally had no one walk through it. You know, downtown overlooking the harbor, something that was one of the more sought after places 20, 30 years ago. And to say, what does that mean for the city? And what does it mean when people aren't coming to Oriole games? And everyone in my world from Pasadena and Harford County and Carroll County saying, I'm not coming downtown anymore because the squeegee boys, because the price of this, the parking, the meters, though I can get it wherever I live. And I said, man, we've really got to fix this. And, you know, with Don running Baltimore County, the last 2 years of just us talking about how can we fix it, right? Like, Baltimore Positive is, I can put the news on any night and hear all this awful stuff about my city, but what's the key to turning it around? And you now see it more from the outside, but know it from the inside. The thoughts of where this starts with education, children, and finding a different way to police than maybe the way we've always done it.
Well, Nestor, that's a lot. And, you know, we can start by writing Don Mohler's name in for the next mayor of Baltimore. You know, he's got my vote. But perception is reality in a place like Baltimore. And, you know, it probably started well before The Wire. And The Wire, a lot of people see as a documentary of sorts. Just not a documentary on policing, but on politics, on education, on the port community. I mean, that was it really ran the gamut of ills. But particularly after the in-custody death of Freddie Gray in 2015, the riots that ensued, and yes, I use the word riots because 42 pharmacies were looted and old folks' homes under construction were burned to the ground. The fire department had their fire hoses cut when they were trying to put out fires. 168 cops were treated as shock trauma for various injuries. So, yeah, we did have a riot. We also had protests. We certainly did. But it was a tough, tough time. And, you know, after that moment, it continued into 2016, because you'll remember, Nestor and Don, we had six police officers who were charged with various crimes up to and including depraved heart murder regarding the in-custody death of Freddie Gray. So it was just a tough time, not only locally in policing, but if you look nationally, that whole 14-15 era with Michael Brown and Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York and Laquan McDonald in Chicago, there was a lot going on mid last decade. And then you get the realities of violent repeat offenders in Baltimore not being held accountable and going to jail. Now, every time I would say that when I was wearing a uniform, I was accused of being depraved myself. You know, you don't care about second chances. Well, of course I do. And I think we need to treat drug addiction and we need to treat mental illness and behavioral disabilities as things that we can treat and rehabilitate. But I do think that jails and prisons are for violent repeat offenders who harm other people. And there's a reality associated with the fact that right now violent repeat offenders in places like Baltimore, and it's occurring in Philadelphia, it's occurring in New York, it's occurring in other places, are getting swept up into this social justice, criminal justice reform moment. and we're losing sight on what's important. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We don't have to put drug addicts and mentally ill people in jail. Okay, check that box. I get it, and everybody else gets it. But we do need to put people who are repeatedly violent and who harm other people and carry guns into jails to at minimally interrupt their behaviors. And that's not happening right now.
Boy, Kevin, there's a lot of wisdom and insight, obviously, in what you just shared, because I think what you just touched on is this whole idea that it doesn't have to be an either or, and maybe talk a little bit about that through the lens of what I think was an unfortunate term in terms of defunding police. When I look at that topic, what it says to me is perhaps we've asked police departments to be too many things over the years, and there's a way to reallocate budgets to take care of social needs and housing needs and drug addiction needs and domestic abuse needs in another way, and let's figure out how we use our resources. It doesn't have to be an either or, and I wonder if you talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, Don, I mean, you nailed it right there. The way you just described it, absolutely most people would agree with you. But, and again, I don't want to get too political, but the cancel culture came up with defund and dismantle. And they mean defund and dismantle. So I don't care what anybody tells you. That's what they mean. And my budget was $500 million a year in Baltimore. And about 85% of that went to salaries and benefits. And Don, you know, from your so many years running the government in Baltimore County, there's not a lot of fat on the bone with police budgets, and the budgets go to pay salaries. So
no, I tell people that all the time.
Well, and I would also,
when people talk about fat in government, they have to understand that about 80% of all government expenditure are in fixed benefits, salaries and benefits.
Right.
When you take that out, there isn't a lot of fat on the bone.
There's not. And, you know, the incoming mayor, the presumptive mayor of Baltimore, recommended as the chair of the Baltimore City Council to cut $22 million from the Baltimore Police Department's budget that he referred to on the news as slush fund money. That's crazy. There's no slush fund money. What he proposed doing was getting rid of the Marine unit in one of our nation's largest harbors, which I don't even think you can do. I think we're probably required to have some type of public safety marine component in a port community. And then he also advocated getting rid of the nation's oldest mounted horse unit in the country, which they do so much work with PR and communities themselves. And we worked really hard with the B&O Railroad Museum to get people, we raise money to erect new stables. So, but to get back to what you said earlier, Don, over the years, and I've been guilty of this myself, when elected officials and other people would come to the police department and say, hey, police department, can you take on this other responsibility? You know, can you take on these other issues because other parts of government and society aren't getting it done? We as police departments and police leaders have been enthusiastic amateurs, right? I'll say yes to anything. Can you do that? Yes, we'll do it. We'll take it on. We'll tackle it. And then we become enthusiastic amateurs and we relieve other people of their responsibilities. So I do think there's absolutely room for improvement, blended services, a blended approach to a lot of these issues. But it doesn't mean that we should take from the police to make these other good things happen.
Give me an example of what you mean about that. Enthusiastic. Give me that term again.
Enthusiastic amateur.
Amateur. Right? Okay.
I'd like to give you a Rocky Balboa line and say I invented that, but I probably didn't.
I was in Philadelphia earlier this week, so I appreciate that.
So it gets back to the 1990s and community policing. You know, should police officers actually staff rec centers and interact with kids in an educational environment and conduct athletic and educational activities? Is that for the police department to do? I mean, I would say no, but when other parts of the government are failing in that regard, police officers get asked to tackle a host of things like trash, blight, other community services. And we start taking on too much. And then our role with dysfunctional families and drug addiction and mental illness. You know, we aren't the experts in that regard, but we should be part of it. And you know, what I did with Dr. Nguyen, speaking of Dr. Nguyen, we got a grant. Actually, she got it. But
by the way, when you say her name, Don and I can't stop smiling because we just like her so much. And she's been a guest on the show as well.
She's a veteran of Baltimore Positive, Kevin.
Garter World has me had me do a webinar recently, and my special guest was none other than Dr. Lena Nguyen.
So she showed up over at Jennings last year. Was she 7 months pregnant, Don? I mean, she showed up on CNN the night before birth, and I think, you know, somewhere right on the other side of the ER, you know, like literally. She's an amazing person. So every time you drop name, I just, makes us smile.
What we did together, Nestor, is we got some money, and we blended. We had this blended approach to crisis. So if it's apparently mental illness or a behavioral crisis and a 911 call comes in, we had during certain hours of the day only in the Central District mental health professionals riding with police officers, and we would respond together to some of these calls for service. But you can't take the police out of that equation or people will get killed or hurt. So the whole notion that we can send social workers and faith folks to these 911 calls for service where danger is imminent and always possible, that's absurd. We can't do that. But I do agree we need a more blended approach to some of these crises.
Well, Kevin, I'm going to ask you, and I promise you we will get to your op-ed, but there's so many things.
We
got to
have three segments. We got to have him back on. That's it.
But no problem. As you do, Nestor and I have tried to make sense for almost 2 years now of the gun trace task force scandal in Baltimore City. And Kevin, I just upfront will tell you that we look at each other, we talk on and off the air, and we say to ourselves, how the hell does this happen? So educate us, as somebody who I'm sure that gave you a lot of pain, walk us through again how that happens in a police department.
Sure, Don. Well, as you can imagine, it happens right under your noses, unbeknownst to you, slowly and over time. When I got to Baltimore, I increased the number of Baltimore detectives assigned to the FBI's anti-corruption task force because I had worked so closely with them when we took down Jack Johnson, who you'll recall was our county executive in Prince George's County. So I had been working with the FBI anti-corruption unit for years and years and years. So I enhanced the number of Baltimore cops that were assigned to that when I got to Baltimore. And as Operation Broken Boundaries started to unfold, and again, it unfolded unbeknownst to me because the feds and the U.S. Attorney's Office keep that away from the local police department, which is in and of itself an issue. But that Broken Boundaries investigation and what is referred to as the GTTF squad, although they've had various names throughout the years, harkens back to 2008. These guys and others have been doing what they were accused of doing and convicted of doing for over a decade before we took them down on March the 1st, 2017. So the whole notion that it was something that just happened is ridiculous. It didn't just
happen. No, but Kevin, I want to stop you. I'm going to interrupt you, and I apologize.
Sure.
Because this is the part that Nestor and I continue to dig down on and can't get an answer to. And I don't mean that it's your responsibility, because as you said, it started way before you. But how does that go on for a decade without numerous officers and numerous supervisors? I mean, when you have cops going in and stealing $100,000 from this safe and driving a car into a crowd of people so they run away, and then making deals with drug dealers to split the profits. Talk to us about the culture and how that happened long before you got there, Kevin.
Yeah, well, Don, the culture is the word, and it's so thick in places like Baltimore, you can cut it with a knife. And let's be honest, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins is a sociopath criminal mastermind. The reason why they got away with it, one of the reasons why they got away with it for so long, is because they were so good at being criminals and keeping it to a tight circle. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, you can always look back and say, well, weren't there red flags that the police department should have seen over the years, like overtime abuse, like racking up internal affairs complaints, racking up civil suits? So all those things are absolutely fair to criticize and to try to improve upon. But I told a group recently, it's the governor's commission to reform police, something to that effect, and I told them that, you know, the fact that this went on for so long indicates that we need to put other measures in place to figure out if misconduct is going on. Like, if you're a federal law enforcement officer, Don, you're going through a financial investigation routinely. You're routinely taking polygraph examinations. They check up on you and your personal lifestyle. They know if you've declared bankruptcy. They know if you're underwater with car payments and house payments. We don't do that in local law enforcement, and we need to do a much, much better job at that.
I guess one of the questions I would have is, if I got hired and I'm a young pup in any capacity, as a officer inside, outside, with a, you know, whatever that would be, and got a whiff of anything like that, and I'm a rank and file anything, where do you even turn with that? How do I even get to you if you're running the whole place? Who could I trust to say, I believe something really awful is going? If anyone down the line knew, how safe would they be, and where could they go for safety?
Well, Nestor, that circumstance that you just described actually happened 3 times during my tenure, where criminal charges and convictions resulted against Baltimore police officers. So police officers can go to someone they trust. They can, communicate anonymously. They can communicate with the local media and elected officials. All those things do happen. But and anonymous tip lines. That there are so many ways that police departments across the country have afforded avenues for people.
But hang on a second. Anonymous tip line. Who's getting it on the other end?
Yeah. And I mean,
that would be my, you know, that
prosecutors. But that's why, you know, I brought in an outside internal affairs chief who worked with me in Prince George's County, who righted that ship, because I needed an outside set of eyes and ears to come in and look at how we were doing things. And we weren't doing some fundamental blocking and tackling. We didn't have an early identification system that was worth a damn. We didn't have an internal psychological services component. We didn't have an officer health and wellness program. So we brought all those things to bear. But the truth of the matter is, Nestor and Don, I was there on March the 1st, 2017, when we put handcuffs on those corrupt cops with the FBI, and I looked each one of them in the eye when those handcuffs were slapped on their wrists, and it was disgusting. I mean, they had been getting away with it for so long under so many different mayoral and police commissioner administrations. I understand the emotion behind how could this happen, but it happened slowly. It happens in a culture that is prone to look the other way, or to excuse, or to mitigate, or to rationalize. And if you harken back to Baltimore's zero tolerance policing years, where we were arresting 110,000, 120,000 residents a year, these guys were treated like heroes because they were making arrests and they were executing search warrants and seizures and drugs and guns, but not enough was put in place to make sure they were doing it the right way. And that's a failure.
Kevin, what was the reaction? I mean, you're the guy that finally put an end to it. What was the reaction among the rank and file as you went from precinct to precinct? Were the officers on the street angry at you as the commissioner and saw you as a turncoat? Or were the officers on the street saying, thanks, boss, it's about time these bad actors went to jail?
No one, Don, was angry at me that I know of when that happened. I think people were embarrassed and they were disappointed. And they were angry at those cops because it embarrasses them and it embarrasses their families and it hurts their credibility each and every time they walk into a courtroom for the foreseeable future. But then there's another group of officers who say, I'm not surprised. And that speaks to culture. So when you have a scandal like this break and people say, I'm not surprised that that happened, I'm not surprised that Don and Nestor were caught up in that. That's like, whoa, 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 time out, yeah. Red flag. What do you mean you're not surprised?
Right.
Because if you're not surprised, that means that something should have happened at a much earlier point in time to have prevented it, and it didn't. And again, that's
where have you been?
That's culture. That's culture.
Where have you been? Well, Kevin, in the midst of all this, the other day you took the time to pen an op-ed, caught my eye, caught Nestor's eye. We immediately reached out and said, hey, we have to have Kevin come on and talk about why this would make a difference. And that is, you're suggesting in the Baltimore Sun that the next president needs to create a cabinet-level position, Secretary of Police. Tell us why that's not window dressing and why it would make a difference.
Well, Don, as you know, there are 18,000 municipal police departments in our country. Half of the 18,000 police departments in our country are 50 police officers or fewer, right? So most police departments in America are small. We have different standards, and we're all over the map when it comes to selection, training, hiring standards, use of force standards, investigation standards internally and criminally. Where you get some police departments that really get it and are shining examples of how to do it right. You get some that are stuck in the 1970s, and then you get a whole bunch of people that are in between. And we need to standardize. I'm not an advocate for the federal government taking over policing, but when I speak to people who come from other countries and they come visit America, and I've had opportunities to interact with tons of people from all over the world, the first thing they all say is, I can't believe you guys have 18,000 police departments here. How do you pull it off? That must be so hard. And they're right. It is hard because there aren't any standards that we're compelled to follow. And I think policing is a very local issue. And I'm still an advocate for local policing. But I do think that there's some national standards that need to be in place to give our profession, if we're going to call it a profession, the credibility that it needs and for people to trust it.
Well, I think we've talked to a lot of folks about just the chokeholds and all of those issues that Black Lives Matters that came up in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd. Some thoughts about all of that, because that was front and center in the eight holes, and we had various guests on for 2 months talking about all of this, but policing is changing, right? I mean, you've been out of it for a couple of years. We're in it most of your life. Since you left it, it's changed, right?
Well, Nestor, I'm going to be critical of a second of the elected officials, and most of them are congressional figures who are throwing things out there that need to be changed that have already been changed. I can't think of a police department that teaches and tolerates chokeholds, right? That's done. You know, we introduced in Baltimore when I was a police commissioner mandatory compliance with a respect for the dignity of life. We made it mandatory that other officers must, notify the police department of misconduct. You know, a lot of the things they're saying they want to be done have already been done or are in progress. So one of the reasons why I wrote this op-ed piece was, let's stop nibbling around the edges of this pie, and let's get to the heart of it all. And at the heart of it all is the fact that we have 18,000 police departments doing 18,000 different things. So, let's talk big ticket items. And that's why I outlined a federal, state, and local. Here are some big ticket things that you can do now to improve policing. So again, the things that you are here advocates who aren't part of this profession advocating for, most of those things that they're advocating for are already done.
Doesn't every municipality have a different – you mentioned so many of these police departments in smaller places and smaller groups of people and what they would need in, a SWAT team or, different things that New York would need that certainly you wouldn't need on the back roads of Iowa. But the funding of it and the technology piece – and the staying up to standard on in every way, from your cars to your uniforms to all facets of policing, the cost of that, much like education and all sorts of things, certainly in the aftermath of COVID, these do fall upon 18,000 different groups of people to pay for it and what they need in their town, right? That would be standard across the board.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And Nestor, here's one example. I first got a camera inside of my police car in Prince George's County in 1998. We had in-car cameras in 1998, and we wore microphones on our gun belt, and we had microphones inside the police cars. When I came to Baltimore in 2015, not one police car had in-car cameras. None.
Wow.
Zero. And mobile data computers. I got my first mobile data computer in my police car in Prince George's County in the 1990s as well. And until I partnered with the Governor Hogan and his Office of Crime Control and Prevention, and they paid $3 million for it. I don't know if people know this, but Governor Hogan is the one who funded mobile data computers for the Baltimore Police Department during my tenure. So Baltimore is just so far behind. In the state of Maryland alone, Nestor and Don, there's 180 police departments. And there are vast differences even amongst the big police departments, the big seven, if you will. And it just needs to be, okay, here's the threshold of professionalism that we are going to demand. And everyone has to, you know, operate in each of those verticals, whether it's selection, hiring, training, discipline, use of force, et cetera. Everyone has to get up to a particular standard. Or else those departments would be decertified. You know, we have to get up to a standard. The only time we tend to pay attention to police departments nowadays is after something bad happens, and we need to pay attention on the front end.
Well, Kevin, I want you now to shift into, because I know you teach this stuff, I want you to shift in to Professor Davis, because, and you've alluded to it, I think, in the last few minutes in your discussion with Nestor. The question becomes, do we have a few bad apples across the country, or do we have a systemic issue? And the real direct question is, if it's just a few bad apples, why do we continually have black men and women being killed at the hands of police officers in the way that we see it happen?
Well, Don, I really have to look at the statistics to see to what extent that bears out in reality. In 2019, I think the number of police-involved shootings in our country was 1,004. So where does that kind of land in terms of what's normal? There are far fewer police-involved shootings, far fewer in-custody deaths, and far fewer uses of force today than there were nearly 30 years ago when I became a police officer. We're certainly more aware of it now. We track it now. We examine data now. We're better trained now than we were, but it's a much larger issue now, and it's at top of mind for all of us, thanks largely to the cell phone camera,
right?
Because seeing is believing. So the profession has come a long, long way. There's no doubt about it. One thing we need to do to ensure, I look for three things in police officers, regardless of rank, and they're must-haves for me. Compassion, empathy, and approachability. Those three things. And we need to find a better way when we hire police officers to do the impossible and to attempt to measure or find out whether they have compassion, empathy, and if they're approachable or not. I think our profession for far too many decades has attracted the thrill seekers who are joining the ranks of our nation's police departments, not for the right reason. And when those thrill seekers also have narcissistic personality tendencies, then that's a recipe for disaster. We have psychological examinations right now for police officers, but we don't do what federal law enforcement does, and it's costly. And all my good ideas, Don, I'm afraid, cost money. But in federal law enforcement, they put each candidate through a battery of behavioral assessments. And we don't do that in local law enforcement. And we need to, because the behavioral assessment analysis is the one that does a much better job at identifying narcissistic personality tendencies. And those are the last people you want to give a badge and a gun to, because they're consumed with power. And police officers can take your freedom away. We can charge you with crimes. And we can even use deadly force. We have to be very careful about who we let into our profession.
Well, Kevin, Nestor's heard me say this. I've said it multiple times on this show. I said it when we had Commissioner Harrison on. A former police chief communicated to me exactly what you just said one day when we were talking about this issue. And he said, Don, if we had a magic solution, if I had a magic potion, it would be one that would allow me to identify on the front end whether the applicant to be a police officer is joining out of a sense of service or out of a sense of adventure. And if I could weed out those who are looking for a sense of adventure, we would solve a multitude of sins.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Don. Yep. I teach a class at American University and a class at Catholic University, and they're mostly freshmen, some sophomores. It's a 100-level class. I'm not even qualified to teach a 100-level class, but I do. So, and they're all in the criminal it's in the criminal justice program. You know how many of my students tend to want to be police officers each and every semester?
Zero.
Right. They want to be lawyers. They want to, you know, go on and do some federal law enforcement. But we have to find a way to attract not only people numerically to our profession, but the right types of people. And maybe we've been looking in all the wrong places.
Kevin Davis is our guest.
Go ahead, Nestor.
Yeah, Director of Consulting Services, Gardner. And to your point, Don, we're going to have him back.
There's no doubt. But before we let him jump, today, and I appreciate his time, we can't have a former police commissioner on without getting your take, Kevin, on whether or not the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights needs another look and whether it's become a detriment to holding police officers accountable in terms of working with the FOP?
Well, Don, I've got a very succinct answer on that I've given publicly on a number of occasions. And I think LEOBR has been around since 1975. My dad was a police officer before there was a police union, and he worked 7 days on and one day off, and they weren't well paid, and the working conditions were sometimes subpar. So I believe in police unions. I'm an advocate. The issue that I have with the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights is with collective bargaining. And I think if we took a scalpel, not a sledgehammer, and we prohibited any discipline provisions to be included in a collective bargaining agreement, a lot of our problems would go away. And what I mean by that is, in Maryland, police chiefs and the police commissioner of Baltimore is not the final authority on matters of discipline. And he or she needs to be. That way we can hold him or her accountable to remove those bad apples that you talked about earlier. And right now the process is so convoluted that it's challenging for police chiefs to do that. So, you know, for any FOP folks that are listening, I'm not against unions. I've benefited from being a member of a union myself. But let's just take a scalpel, remove any collective bargaining agreement provisions for discipline, And let's give that final authority to the head of the organization.
Well, Kevin, I said many times, and Don and I have been on this from the beginning as well, that we could talk about anything Baltimore positive, anything great that could happen here, but it really does come back to we've got to solve crime. That sits at the front of it. It sat in the front of the mayor's race. It'll be on the other side of this. And we really appreciate your insights into this, because certainly, I mean, this has been your life, man. And we appreciate your service as well here in Baltimore a couple years ago, and glad that you're doing well, and appreciate your insights.
Well, thanks, Nestor and Don, and have me on. I've got a face for radio, so bring me back sometime.
Hey, we're going to zoom you up and get you a pro mic around here is what we're going to do, right?
We'll count on you as being our public safety consultant. It's really been terrific, Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for going extra time with us as well. Kevin Davis, the former police commissioner for the Baltimore PD, that was back in 15, 16, 17, and 18. First-time guest there. I'm going to be linking in with him. Don Moeller and I present all of these great Baltimore positive chats. And sometimes, we gotta talk about crime as well in regard to this. And it's not an easy topic, for sure, anytime we get together. We appreciate our friends at Taharka for supporting us, our friends at State Fair, where I had the chicken and waffles, Fadley's, where we hope to very, very soon maybe get together with Kevin Davis for some Fadley's crab cakes. You can still ship them anywhere. And our friends at Moeller & Gary Realty, Don's son, Jeff, doing a great job of closing deals, even from 6 feet away, out on Zoom, and selling homes in a very, very interesting housing market. Learn more at Moeller & Gary. We appreciate all of our sponsors. Certainly very, very appreciative to Kevin Davis for joining us and being a part of our Baltimore Positive presentation. There's lots and lots of stuff, including some merging going on from all of our Baltimore Positive conversations now, almost 300 deep. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net. We are calm, we're local, and we're Baltimore Positive.